We're going to talk about Royal Dutch Shell in Nigeria now. Now, last Thursday, Judge Kimber Wood of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York rejected Royal Dutch Shell's motion to dismiss a human rights case charging the company and the head of its Nigerian operation, Brian Anderson, with complicity in the torture and killing of peaceful Nigerian protesters more than 10 years ago. Shell's last-ditch attempt to avoid trial claimed the court did not have jurisdiction to consider the case. But Judge Wood, in a 25-page ruling, overwhelmingly supported plaintiffs' international law claims for extrajudicial killing, torture, arbitrary detention, and crimes against humanity. And the trial will start on May 26th of this year. And joining us to talk more about this case is attorney Judith Chomsky, who is the cooperating CCR lawyer and trial counsel for this case. Attorney Judith Chomsky, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Any relation to Noam?
Yes.
Oh, I figured. That's some serious credentials that you bring to this.
Well, I only married in, so I...
Oh, you married in.
So I so can't be charged with being that smart.
Oh, I don't know. Marital rights, property, all that kind of good stuff. You get intellectual property as well as the other stuff. Thank you for joining us. I remember this case personally because I covered it in London, and remember Ken Sarawiwa and the whole Sarawiwa family, and how much anger there was around the time. So I wondered if you could just cycle back a little bit for us and remind us of some of the details of the case as far as Shell and what it was doing in the Ogoni territories in Nigeria.
Well, the deceased Ken Sarawiwa was an environmental activist and a partisan in support of the small tribe he comes from, the Ogoni. He challenged Shell, which at that time was two companies, Royal Dutch Petroleum and Shell Transport and Trading, and said that they owed the people of Ogoni several things, including reparations for the environmental damage they did and remediation of the mess that they had left behind. The movement was the first time that these environmental issues were from a small tribe in Africa was put on an international stage, and that was really his genius. He organized both inside Nigeria and internationally. The first Ogoni Day had half of all Ogoni at one huge rally. So he was a great organizer. At that time, the government of Nigeria was a military dictatorship, and Shell was very much aligned with that dictatorship and with the ones that preceded it and the ones that followed it. Because of his opposition and the organized opposition of the Ogoni, the military, with the assistance of Shell, attacked people inside of Ogoni, and in 1994 arrested Ken Sarawiwa and many of the leaders, and had a kind of mock trial, which ended in their hanging in November of 1995 to the outrage of the world.
I remember it very well indeed. It was an extraordinary day, and you know that his death was torturous because of the botched way in which he was essentially assassinated. One of the things his son said, which he always quoted that his father said, is that one day Shell will be on trial, and that day certainly has come to be. So just, can you just from a legal point of view, just break down the actual case and what it is that's being fought for?
Well, we filed a year after the hanging,
right,
in 1996, and the case had a long and difficult uphill battle. It was one of the first cases brought against a corporation for human rights violations. It's been brought under a 200-year-old statute that permits non-citizens, aliens, to come to court in the United States to make claims based on international law or international humanitarian law. So we brought the claim. At first, it was dismissed. We appealed the dismissal, and the Second Circuit, the appeals court, the Federal Appeals Court for New York, said, among other things, that the people of New York had an interest in ensuring that human rights were recognized and enforced through our legal system. And that was a big breakthrough. The next thing was defendants moved to dismiss. For a number of reasons, and they lost that. And then there were kind of endless discovery fights, and eventually the judge set a trial date, and defendants have tried various subterfuges to bring motions that are now out of time. And the latest was a claim that the court in the federal court didn't have jurisdiction over the plaintiff's human rights claims. And they include claims for torture, for extrajudicial killing, and for crimes against humanity. And all three of those claims were upheld by Judge Kimball Wood in her latest ruling.
And so the individual actually named in the case is Bryant Anderson, another name that I and many of my journalist colleagues know very, very well in London, who headed Nigerian operations. And, you know, I should say that the Ogoni, in terms of their organization, always reminded me of what I saw in the 1960s with the African Americans and the civil rights, that it was almost militaristic in its organization, very clear, persistent, consistent, went on. I think certainly Shell thought that with the assassination of Ken Saro-Wiwa Sr., that the fight would be over, underestimating the extent to which Wiwa had kind of extended the tentacles of that battle all the way into the international community, both on the grassroots level, on the legal level, and right across different, across class and race, using the law on the one hand, social justice on the other, gathering Africans of major significance like Wole Soyinka, who is an exceptional writer, very, very well known, both in Nigeria and around the world, for his critique of what has happened in Nigeria in terms of its military leadership. So Bryant Anderson, who is the gentleman that is named, I wonder if you could tell us a bit about him. He headed Nigerian operations, and he is personally named in the suit.
He was the managing director, as they call it, the head of Shell's operation in Nigeria in 1995, actually beginning in January of 1994.
Right.
And he came to New York. He lives now in China. And he came to New York, and he was served with papers while he was in New York, which under U.S. law gives the court personal jurisdiction over him. And we have alleged that he is liable for conspiring and aiding and abetting the Nigerian military dictatorship in their repression in Ogoni and in the execution of Ken Saro-Wiwa and eight others. It's just going back to what you said about the organization. Even today, Shell does not operate in Ogoni. And so while other communities in the Delta suffer from Shell's release of of gas from their oil operations so that it burns into the night sky. Operates with corroded pipes exposed on the ground. That is no longer happening in Ogoni, because the organization that Ken Sarawiwa and others created has so taken root that there's really still a strong sense of community solidarity and activism.
You know, and it's important to note that with Ken Sarawiwa, as with Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, all of those great leaders, that whilst the individual name was the name that came to be kind of entrenched in the memory for so many of us, he was part of a major organization, and it was the organization that he was part of that was so successful. And the warrior spirit of the people of Nigeria, especially in the early 1990s, who took to the streets knowing that Shell was making payments that provided arms to security forces that they knew would be abusive to local communities, knowing that there was a military government which in consistently meted out violent repression of the demonstrations and then arrested and bribed witnesses. All of those things were reported in the 1990s, and they did not quell the protests, and that definitely spoke to, you know, as I said, the warrior spirit of the people of Ogoni in Nigeria. And as I said, it would always remind me, and when we did stories about it, there would be a comparative analysis with seeing the water hoses and the dogs being turned on African Americans, seeing the people of the young people of Soweto continue to rise up even against those kinds of totally inhumane, torturous authorities. So it is an extraordinary day, 14 years later, that this day is being had formally in the courts. So then, can we just talk about the potential, let's just assuming that if justice finds its way and the evidence is seen to be what it seems to be, that Brian Anderson and Shell are found guilty, what kind of suits are we looking at? What kind of sentences are we, might we be looking at?
Well, this is a civil matter. This is not a criminal matter.
No, it's not criminal.
So there won't be any sentence. It is a kind of sad fact of our legal system that people who commit grave crimes against other human beings sometimes often escape criminal prosecution, and instead we compensate the victims with money. But I think there's something more, and that is that if there's an award from a jury, especially a significant award, it will send a message to other multinational companies that there is some way for people to have redress against them. This is part of a movement to force corporations to be responsible, to hold them liable when they enter into partnerships with abusive governments and make their profits basically off the human rights violations of their, you know, government partners.
You know, the challenge here as well, though, is that Shell was in cahoots with the military government, and the military government was installed by Western powers. And one of the ways in Nigeria, as is the case in Pakistan, is the intervention of civilian rule with military rule created the kind of chaos that consistently presented opportunities to the multinationals. So I think it becomes a bigger conversation, though, even about what money does or doesn't do in terms of the message of the multinationals, as much as it becomes the conversations about the interference in government by Western authorities, because the mineral wealth of that nation serves oil-rich, oil-poor nations like the U.S., and that's been part of the troubled history in terms of Nigeria and the U.S., also Great Britain, that there has been a consistent conversation around the intervention in government and the installation of military governments and the degree to which that has then served multinationals against the will of the people. And the message that needs to be sent is not simply to the multinationals, but also to the governments. And it speaks to, as well, President Obama talking about the arrogance of nations like the US that have wielded power on other people's soil for the benefit of their own interests without thinking about the long-term consequence and damage of that. So when we speak about the length of time that we expect the trial to go on for, do we have any kind of timeline for that?
Well, we expect the trial to last about a month, which would include both our putting on our affirmative case and the defendants putting on their defense. So we think that the trial will end towards the end of June. And I suspect that if we prevail, which I believe we will, the defendants will probably try to go to the Second Circuit, back to the appeals court,
right,
to delay justice once again.
Mm.
I just going back to your point about the ability of Western governments and Western-based companies to interfere in the domestic life of people all over the world. You know that Shell is basically an English and Dutch company, and Shell entered into Nigeria when Nigeria was not independent. Basically, Shell came with the British Empire, and it still dominates the economy. Over 50% of the income of the government in Nigeria comes from Shell. So there's no question that it continues to wield overwhelming authority in Nigeria.
And I wonder what impediment to justice that may be, given that kind of, I call it false authority, but I mean it's real, insofar as that there is a power denomination there. And I call it the continuation of economic colonialism. Nigeria may have acquired independence of a sort in 1961, but the kind of environmental havoc that Shell wreaked over many, many years, decades, in fact, with the the assistance of governments and to the blind eyes of Western governments, continues to remind all of us about what happens when you have this, the degree to which business totally runs government to the detriment of the people, to which enables human rights abuses to happen in that sense.
It is shocking to me to be in Nigeria, in the countryside, to know of the wealth that's being extracted from the Niger Delta, and to see the poverty and the absolute absence of infrastructure, no public education, barely any roads. I mean, the people in the villages in Ogoni still have no electricity. They don't have running water, and they don't have a clean environment. That's the legacy of Shell's involvement in the Delta.
And hopefully this case will bring an end to a legacy. And, I always say, even with all that there is not, that spirit, that warrior spirit that has continued for so many decades, not just among the Ogoni, among the Yoruba, the Igbo, you see it again and again among the peoples of Nigeria and right across the continent of Africa, is what enables a case like this to even come to trial in the first place. Attorney Judith Chomsky, cooperating CCR lawyer and trial counsel for this case. Certainly this is a story that we would like to come back to. We thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for giving me an opportunity to tell your listeners about the Ogoni struggle.
Thank you.
Bye. These governments are killing their own.